Death is a big mystery, and yet the outcome is 100% certain. How do you plan for the unknown? Denial works wonders for a while, but death always shows up.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Kathy Zoitlin, filmmaker and director, writer, producer of the documentary Living While Dying from Portland's Peace Films. Living While Dying was an official selection of the 2018 Portland Film Festival and winner of the Resiliency and Aging Award at the 2018 Third Action Film Festival in Calgary. The film follows four terminally ill people in the last days of their lives. Kathy is our guide as we watch each of them face the end in different ways, coming to terms with their mortality and finding some peace, even joy, in the journey. I met Kathy at Cedars-Sinai Park in Portland, where she works as the spiritual life coordinator. My dad was a resident first in assisted living and then, as his health deteriorated, in the long-term care facility. I was hesitant to talk to my dad about death, which, given his condition, could come at any time. Kathy agreed to discuss the topic with him, and that gave great peace of mind to both him and me. He passed away peacefully in his sleep last November at the age of 95. Please join us for our conversation with Kathy Zoitlin, which is already in progress. Well, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today. While prepping for the interview, I read that KBOO sponsored the very first Portland screening of Living While Dying. That was back in November 2017 at the Clinton Street Theater. So it's great to continue the relationship.
I'm so grateful to KBOO. Thank you.
Now, Kathy, you've been working on films and making your own since the 1970s. In fact, you dropped out of UC Santa Cruz as an undergrad to make movies, and you were a pioneer as a woman making films about women's lives for other women. So you have a lot of expertise as a cinematographer, producer, director, and writer. And on Living While Dying, you put pretty much all those skills to use. You even narrated and appear in the film. Has this been a more personal film for you than your previous work?
Actually, most of my work has been personal on one level or another. It was very personal to get involved in filmmaking. I was in the women's movement at UC Santa Cruz, and I was involved in a number of different activities, I would say. We were both part of the anti-war movement and also part of the feminist movement of the time. We were working to legalize midwives to be able to, you know,
deliver
attend
babies,
and
yeah.
deliver babies. And I got into filmmaking in order to change the image of women on the screen. I know it's very idealistic because, you know, but we were young and idealistic in those days. And
what a great time to get into film, huh? So much was happening in the early 70s.
I didn't even see film as art when I initially got involved. I saw it as social commentary, you know. So I was part of a women's collective, and we really had a purpose, a social purpose.
Now, you say in the film that once you reached your 60s and were both baby boomers, you can no longer ignore death. Denial, which is pretty much standard practice for most of us, wasn't working for you anymore. Was that realization that you couldn't keep denying your own mortality a big part of the film's origin?
For sure, that was part of the film's origin. I have to say all the time that this particular film seems to have made itself through me. I didn't set out with a notion of how the film would come together. I just set out with curiosity.
It seemed almost a calling. it was a calling to you.
Yes, it was a calling.
As we go along, I'll point out some amazing, fortuitous coincidences that happen during the making of the film. Now, it follows four terminally ill people in their final days. They know they're dying, and the camera records how they choose to live out the rest of their lives. The first of the four is Claire Killen, who you describe as your mom's 92-year-old lover. I just love that description. It seems almost contradictory to most of us, but not to people who know folks at that age. Now, Claire has a terminal prostate cancer, and your mom, Johnny, who's also in her 90s at the time of the film, becomes his caregiver in home hospice. How did you approach Claire and your mom with the idea for the film and ask their permission to film this very intimate event?
Well, because of my relationship with my mom and Claire, you know, we had an ongoing, I knew Claire a little pretty well, enough to ask the permission. I'll put it like that. And as soon as I asked his permission, he said, "Oh, Kathy, I would love you to come and film me. I'm a Leo." And actually what happened, I think, is that for Claire, who was a project person, this became another project. You know, he would think about, "Oh, Kathy's coming down." He lived in Ashland and I'm in Portland. And he would think ahead about like, "Oh, if Kathy's coming down, I guess I'll go get my haircut while she's here." Or, you know, he would come up with a little something to do, like a co-producer of the film.
He was collaborating on the film.
Yes.
He didn't want you to film him sitting there, not doing anything.
Well, he didn't mind that either. You know, he just welcomed the camera, actually.
Now, you show him talking about his impending death and accepting it, though he's sad about it, and at some points he cries in the interview. It's very touching to watch. But he also said the dying process brought a new clarity, a heightened awareness. And for example, you mentioned that haircut, which took place at his barber's in Ashland. When it's finished, he says, "Don't get me wrong. Don't misunderstand my intent, but I feel like I've been made love to." It's a beautiful scene, and you capture it so well on film. And that's just something he invited you, "Hey, come with me. I'm going to get a haircut."
Yeah. And we showed up at the haircutting place, and I think it was like a day that it was closed, and Clarence called the haircutter and said, "Would you please come in?" You know, and he did. And he did a special favor, and Claire had reached a very heart-open place at that time of his life, and he was just happy to express that.
Yeah, it shows in the film. Now, dying seems to bring him to this point, and also the realization that he says in the film that he's not in charge. And it can seem contradictory to some of us, especially those who aren't happy when we're not in charge, we're not in control. It seems almost like a joy of letting go, of ceding control, of just kind of giving in to whatever the universe has for you next, almost a religious experience.
I think Claire would go with you up to religion.
Oh, okay. And we'll talk about that. There's several perspectives in the film from different viewpoints.
I think life is full of those kinds of contradictory two truths at once. You know, that he could get into that place of fully accepting, you know, that he's mortal and life is ending. And then that gave him this access to this open-hearted place inside of him that he'd always had, but he was just like really happy to be expressing it more. And letting go is one of the hardest things that humans do, I think. And so it's always just like you say it so you can do it. I think that's what was going on for Claire and for a lot of us who are in the process of constantly remembering that we're not in charge.
And it, oddly enough, it brings a certain happiness, a certain release.
Yes, yes.
The next of the four subjects is your friend Alan Rosie Rosenberg, and he goes by the name of Avietz in the film, and you describe him as a realtor, writer, marketing consultant, but he's also a dancer and apparently an aspiring stand-up comedian. How did you meet Avietz?
I knew Avietz in my Jewish community. He's in the congregation that my mom was in Ashland, and it's part of Jewish Renewal, and I'm in a Jewish Renewal congregation here in Portland. So I just knew him in that larger community.
And he has this wonderful sense of humor, especially in light of this terrible diagnosis. He has cancer, which has spread to his liver. And one goal of his is to do a few stand-up comedy shows before he dies. And the material is all about his own experience during these last days. For example, he says, "Now when I go shopping at Costco, I bring two lists, my shopping list and my will." And I don't know if I do justice to that line. He says it better. He delivers it better. As a Jew myself, that kind of dark humor, that laughter in the face of tragedy, seems very Jewish, something that might have sustained us even throughout a history of oppression, anti-Semitism. But no matter a dying person's religion, I'm thinking a good sense of humor can't hurt. And these subjects seem to share that.
For sure. And Avyeitz, it really, similar in a way to Claire, became another one of my co-producers. He also had like, oh, I know a scene you could film. And and he, I don't think I ended up putting the scene in the movie, but he invited a whole bunch of friends over for a potluck, a Shabbat dinner. And, you know, it was a musical evening. He had aspirations as a musician as well as a comedian. And so, you know, it was an opportunity for him to play music and, you know, have community around. And he was beloved in his community. He was one of the people who baked fresh challah, you know, often, and made sure to bring it for gatherings. And so another thing he did was organize a living, I don't know if it's a memorial because he was still alive, but it was a, I don't know what other word to use, a celebration of life. He organized a celebration of life for himself while he was alive. So it was an opportunity for him to offer blessings to people. He gathered people in the sanctuary and he wanted to offer blessings. And of course, people wanted to offer blessings to him as well.
Now, in the film, we leave Claire and Avyeitz for the moment while you and your husband travel to Australia. You're on a house exchange. That seems like an interruption in the making of the movie, but it turns out to be serendipitous. What was the reason for the trip, Kathy?
Initially, the reason for the trip was that I have friends in Australia who wanted to do a house exchange. They had family in Portland, and you know, and my husband and I love traveling. I was also all along working. Oh, now I can remember some of the origins of the movie. I was working on a project that we called Holy Rascals. And when we started making this particular movie, we were thinking about how do Jews in particular face the end of life? And we had some sort of notion that there might be something we could say about that, which turned out I still can't. But
I don't know if there's any uniform way we do that.
And Holy Rascals was all about learning from every different spiritual tradition. It wasn't about only learning from Judaism, although one of, you know, my co-creators for Holy Rascals happens to be a rabbi. He's like a Zen rabbi, you know, just, you know, Rabbi Rami Shapiro. And
it sounds like a sketch.
He's funny. He's terrible. He's a very humorous person. Anyway, he had been introducing me to spiritual teachers from a lot of different traditions. And so I thought going to Australia was an opportunity for me to find Aboriginal teachers, you know, an ancient tradition, and learn about death and dying from someone who's Aborigine. So that's what I set out to do. You know, so I added that purpose to this trip to Australia. And
that's in the movie.
Yeah.
You find an Aboriginal elder, Uncle Bob Randall, and he's, at the time, he's working with his dying nephew. And you were able to witness these lessons on living and dying. And he believes, as do many religions, and I think even science and physics in particular, that there's an eternal spirit or energy that never dies.
Right.
That lives on when our physical body dies, moving into another space. In the film, it's like describing moving into the next room.
Right.
Going beyond the door. And that we can even communicate on this side with those who died, who are in the spiritual world. And you and your mom both had experiences to support this, including on the very day Claire passed.
For my mom, that was one of her experiences. She had what felt like very definite, clear communication with Claire, although he was no longer embodied.
And that was this a silver thread she saw dancing outside her window.
Right.
And she felt that Claire was communicating with her directly as he was dying or past that point.
He'd already died.
And you also, in the film, you saw a beautiful rainbow in Australia.
And now I always think of Claire in connection with those rainbows. I wasn't there when Claire died, but now I'm not remembering clearly the order of events, but it's definitely was connected that when Claire died, I saw a rainbow, and that's my, you know, way of knowing Claire is, you know, transformed and available.
And when Uncle Bob mentioned with communicating with people who've died, you were agreeable right away. You said that you've, and I've got a quote here, I've talked with dead people all my life.
I do talk to people who have been my close friends. I think of them as angels in my life. I do, because they were angels alive. And I just think they still are.
Well, that's a nice way to think of them, especially also when looking at a rainbow and thinking of Claire.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, again, in Australia, not just Uncle Bob, but you also meet Zenith.
Zenith,
who describes herself as a death walker. And that's something like a midwife for the dying. How did you and Zenith connect, and what did she teach you as this death walker? First of all, what is a death walker in Australian?
She created the term. She walks beside people who are facing death. You know, so nowadays, a lot of people will use the word death doula, and it comes, a doula isn't someone who will accompany people, often associated with birth, you know, so there's birth doulas.
That's where that midwife for the dying, yeah.
Yeah, and so these processes have, you know, some similarities. In one case, it seems as if, you know, like, I mean, I know the actual birth is not coming from nothing to something, but at some point, birth is from nothing to something, and at some point, death is from something to nothing, even though we're both of us acknowledging that something has an eternalness to it.
And the nothing doesn't really exist, probably.
And nothing is something, and something is nothing.
Right.
Yeah, so Zenith had an experience with a best friend dying that introduced her to care for people who had just died. And then it became known in the community as a person who was willing to walk with people who were in hospice or who were facing death, and just has done that for so many people in her community. That's death walking.
Yeah, and you mentioned death doula, and there were, I think I said before, all these fortunate coincidences that happened to you during the making of the film. There was one that happened to me just yesterday in the Sunday Oregonian. There was an article about a death cafe in Lincoln City on the Oregon coast, and I read that it's part of an international organization where people can meet and talk about death and dying. And the facilitator in Lincoln City said that she actually works as a death doula. Mm-hmm. Which sounds a lot like
it's
Zenith.
The same.
And you found out about death cafes, I think, while filming Living While Dying. You've talked in interviews before about Holly Pruitt.
Holly is an amazing organizer and another, you know, also a celebrant for people who have died and also other life events, and has helped a lot of people to understand death and dying, including through death cafes, but far beyond that, and helped organize information for people who are facing mortality.
She also provides resources in addition to consolation, comfort for those who are dying and, yeah. and maybe their loved ones who are watching them go through this process.
Yeah, she's a very good teacher for people who are facing mortality.
Now, the death doula in the article, her name's Crystal Meneses. I think I pronounced it right. She said, "We are trained to ask questions or present prompts that encourage people to have conversations about death." Did you have similar questions and prompts when talking to the subjects in the film and maybe some of the elders that you work with as part of your work at Cedars-Sinai? Or
it becomes a very self-selecting group of people. There are people who want to have this conversation, and so they're open to it. I mean, in terms of the filmmaking, the people who are in my film wanted to have that conversation, did feel open to talking about death and dying. And I think my film fills a very little niche for people who want that conversation. There's a ton of people who will face death in all different sorts of ways. You know, there's lots of people face it, you know, by being in denial. And so
maybe the majority of us, huh?
Maybe. I don't know. Or people who want to put up more resistance or fight. And it's all right for that person. I just happen to be given a group of people who wanted to have a lot of open curiosity about it.
And that gift of giving these people, again, seemed to be those happy coincidences. When you returned from home from Australia in the film, a friend introduced you to Douglas Amy, and he goes by the name of Azul Papaji. And Azul has a terminal illness, but has already outlived the prognosis by a year. He practices meditation, lives a very healthy lifestyle in terms of diet and exercise. But he also sees illness as a blessing. It's something he feels he's prepared for through meditation, that act of letting go and acceptance and being here now, as Ram Dass said, which opens up his heart even more. That must have been an inspiration to just witness this. I mean, it was for me, watching the film.
It definitely was. And he was so open. And he shared some of his panic as well as his openness, you know, just like, because the actual experience of not being able to breathe is a physical panic, and that happened for him. So he was willing to share the suffering side and the philosophical side, I guess you could say, the soul journey side, yeah. And he wanted to be a teacher. He wanted to be in the film because he wanted to share things as a teacher.
And I think you've said about the whole film, it's really an education about death.
For me.
I think for the people who watch the movie. Now, at this point in the film, you travel out of the country again, and this time to Bali with your mom and family, and she really wanted to go there. And it's kind of a farewell trip for her. Though, as you told me before the interview, she's still around.
Yeah, it wasn't a farewell at all.
Right. And while there, you come across a mass cremation ceremony. How'd you learn about the ceremony and get invited? And what did you take away? You mentioned in the movie that this takes place only every few years. Not common.
That was just good luck. Again, because of the container of holy rascals, I was always looking for what goes on in other cultures. And so, you know, yet another opportunity to see another culture. And so I start reaching out, who knows anybody in Bali and who knows anybody who knows anything about death and dying. And, you know, friends linked me to friends. And so we ended up in this little small town where it's a ritual that takes place, I believe it's every 4 years. And the friends just invited us to their house, and the whole town closed down, and they burn. The tradition is they have they have to bury bodies when they die, but then they will get them and bring them out in order to do a ceremony, the burning ceremony, and build these giant animals and burn their ancestors with the animals, and then the ashes are sent into the rivers that go into the ocean, and so that's part of the whole life cycle.
Life cycle. And is that to bring them closer to their ancestors and to those who passed away? That mass cremation when they all come out, and it is somewhat of a celebration of life too, or is it more somber?
It has celebration, and it has somber, and it has ritual, and I don't have enough of a, you know, like, historical education to know, you know, like, its purpose on that level, the level you're asking me the question, so I can't really say.
Now, while in Bali, you hear from the fourth subject in the film, and that's a tango partner of yours. You're in a tango dancing club in Portland. His name's Don, and he goes to a walk-in clinic for a seemingly trivial matter, constipation, I think, and finds out 2 days later that he has late-stage cancer and not long to live. But he wants to hold out another 2 weeks so he can end his life through Oregon's Death with Dignity program. Now, he's accepting it at ease with the prognosis, again, amazingly enough. He's not even sad, but also, like the other three, considers it a great chance to open up his heart. Do you think having this agency over dying through Death with Dignity, which we have in Oregon, they certainly don't have that in every state, helped get him to that place?
For Don, that was absolutely part of it, yes. Yes, not having to... His particular diagnosis had a very, you know, without Death with Dignity would have involved a lot of suffering, and he chose the Death with Dignity, you know, as a way to end his life. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm somewhat familiar with the program. I actually had a guest, an author who lived in Eugene. I'd interviewed about four times, and she contracted bulbar onset ALS. So it's not a Stephen Hawking ALS where you can keep living, though your body breaks down a bit. It's kind of a death sentence. And I actually did the last interview with her through Zoom, and she took her own life through the Death of Dignity program and was very resolute about it. Her husband, her friends said, no, hang on, but she kind of knew. And that was just last January. So I know she had to go through a lot. She had to convince or persuade two doctors that really there was no hope. And then there's medications you give you. And the one reason she accelerated it was because as part of the program, you actually have to administer the medication yourself. Yeah. You can't have somebody else do it. So she wanted to do that before she was physically...
While she could swallow.
Right. Physically unable. Yeah. But yeah, it was a program that she welcomed, and I just can't even conceive of what a decision like that would be for people like, her name's Kai Emmons and Don.
I think we can't imagine it because we're not facing it. At that time, if one of us were to have that diagnosis, and it's pretty, you know, it's like it's an unquestionable diagnosis, all the doctors agree, you will die from this condition that you now have, then your decision-making might change.
Yeah, again, there's a lot of us would have that denial going, well, they're wrong, you know?
That could happen. Yeah.
Or maybe they'll come up with some medicine or some cure in the next week.
Yeah, yeah. That can happen too, yeah.
Now, the film ends with you talking about death with your mom, asking her if she's ready, if there's anything she wants when she's dying. You actually have her laying down in a simulated coffin, a box, a wooden box, asking her if she'd like another pillow, things like that to make her comfortable. And she makes somewhat of a confession, if that's the right word, where she says she felt she wounded you, Kathy, and your siblings, and she wants you to know how much she loves you, and it says that that's just part of the healing process. What was that like for you? How did that make you feel and affect your relationship with your mom? It was very brave of her.
My mom's a brave woman. And that is the way she talks. So I think it can be more surprising if you're not raised by this person, but having been raised by her,
you know her well.
That was just my mom being herself. She was a good sport, willing to climb in the coffin, that's for sure.
Whose idea was that? Yours?
It was my idea because I'd seen all these films about death and dying. And when you want to have a conversation with someone, it's like, well, where are you going to have that conversation? You know, and every film seemed to me they were having that conversation while walking through a cemetery. And okay, that's a good visual, mm-hmm. but I'd seen it and it seemed kind of like cliche. So I was thinking, like, how do I do a non-cliche visual? And that's where that came from, was just the trying to come up with a visual because I'm making a movie.
And she said, okay, yeah, I'll go ahead. I'll lay down in the coffin and talk with you.
Yeah. And we were both, I mean, after all, it is just a box.
Right. And it's not an Edgar Allan Poe story.
And you fit in it. My image before making the film was that we would sit in it together, but we didn't both fit in it. So so I had to sit outside.
You need one of those double wide coffins.
Right.
Now, the film ends with you filling out an advance directive, which you consider an act of love. And I did the same thing with my dad before he passed. Can you tell us first of all, what is in an advance directive and why you feel it's so important? Not just to the person dying, but the people they leave behind.
Yeah, it's more important to the people you leave behind than the person themselves, I think, because advance directives are, this is what I want when I can no longer speak for myself. So it's like you have to think through situations where, what if you were hit by a car and you were, you know, unconscious essentially, and you couldn't speak for yourself. Do you want a feeding tube? Do you want, right, you know, heroic efforts? And so during the advance directive process, you say, I do want this, I don't want that. And you're giving guidance to people who will have to make decisions on your behalf. So it's loving to them, because instead of making them have to think, what would she want? They know what you want. You've written it out.
Right. That was very helpful to me and also to the people at the hospital. I think I had three choices. One was do pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
Two was do this, this, and this. And three was keep me alive no matter what.
Right.
Almost if I'm in a vegetative state, you know, and my heart's still beating, keep that going, even though it's going to go on for years. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes you think. It must also bring the reality of death closer to the person filling out the directive. I think it did that with my dad, though he really had no illusions.
Right. Yeah.
About, you know, staying alive forever.
Right. I think if you live, you know, into your 90s, those illusions do, you know, lessen. Mm-hmm. And I think it's useful to everybody to fill out that advance directive. And I think it's also really hard because it does mean, oh, yeah, me too. I'm also mortal.
Right. Now, you have a service, Kathy, what you call legacy films. I saw on your website. And those are interviews with those who are elder or close to death, maybe through ill health or because of their age. What's the process for making the films, and what do you find are the benefits, again, for the subjects of the film and the people that love them, friends and family?
Well, it's exactly what the title is, a legacy film. It's just it's an opportunity for an elder in a family to say everything. It's like having a living will on film. So it's an opportunity for a person while they're alive and cognitively with it to offer their values and their thoughts and their way of thinking and a recording of themselves that people who survive them get to have.
And I saw one, I don't know if it was officially a legacy video, but there was a friend of my dad who died a few months after he did, so earlier in the year. And you had an interview with her at Robeson Cedars-Sinai's long-term care facility.
Right.
And that was just beautiful. And for me, it was, she's gone, but she's on the screen.
Right.
You know,
it's really nice for the family to be able to see someone when they were feeling well enough to be interviewed and walk around or move around in a wheelchair or wave their arms if they're in a bed, or even if they're not able to wave arms, you know, just to, you know, like blink eyes. Anyway, at whatever stage people are at, if they want to give that visual gift to people who survive them, it's a nice gift.
Yeah, and I certainly appreciate it when I saw the one for this one resident who I was friends with too. You really miss her. Now, last April, I read an obituary in the New York Times for Rabbi Harold Kushner. I think he's most famous for the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People, but he also wrote one called When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. And the obituary quoted him talking about the book. He said, "We are not afraid of dying so much as not having lived." Is that something you found in your own work, maybe making the film or talking with people who are terminal or very old?
In the end of the process of making Living While Dying film, I just felt so in touch with living is the process, and dying was a misnomer in a way. Like, dying is, you know, like, yes, it can be a process, or it can be sudden. It you know, it's there for everybody. But really, the focus, my focus came so clear to be about living. And, you know, and the Living While Dying is the title, of course, but that it's really important to pay attention to how we live. That's, you know, most people tend to die in the same way that they lived. So how you're living is likely to predict how you'll die.
Can you give an example, like, you're dying in the same way that you live?
I mean, we'll just talk about Claire, who's in the movie. You know, he lived a curious, creative life, and he died a curious, creative death. Azul was a teacher as he was alive, and then in his death, he continued to want to be a teacher.
And Aviat's very funny, joyous, life of the party type guy. Huh?
Yep. And took a few things, you know, to the grave with him that were unresolved, and that's the way he lived. So all of it, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Now, we talked about, Bali and the Aboriginal elder in Australia. So you cover several perspectives on death, you know, Australia, Bali, the mass cremation, Azul, who practices meditation, and I think Hindu. I thought it was kind of very Buddhist,
right,
some of his philosophy. And then, of course, Aviat's almost a Jewish comedian. Have you found a common thread between all these approaches? Perhaps something you've embraced for your own life, this multicultural, multi-religious approach to dying. There are some similarities and there are some differences.
Embracing life is across the board, no matter what culture. And after people have died, honoring people who are dead is across the board in every culture.
Yeah, I know in an interview, it's not in the movie, but you were in Mexico. And you said something, if I was in Mexico making this movie, there'd be no reason to make the movie.
You know, they have already so much awareness with Day of the Dead being an annual event.
And all the skeleton models and people dress up as skeletons.
And so the conversation about life and death is ongoing there in a much more public way. So it isn't as hidden as it was. It's more hidden here. I don't feel that it's hidden anymore for me in particular, because having made the film, it becomes a conversation that I'm very comfortable with. And, you know, after making the film, I moved into working at assisted living. So it's an ongoing conversation where I work.
And I know when my dad was there, well, even now you're still there, and dying is somewhat of a regular occurrence.
It is a regular occurrence, mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you work with people individually? I know when my dad, it was before he died, so at least 6 to 8 months, and I kind of knew it, you know, his health was really deteriorating, had all sorts of heart problems, but I mean, everything was breaking down. And I was very reluctant, hesitant to talk to him about dying, but I asked you
right. To
do it, which you very graciously and kindly did. You said there was HIPAA, so you can't exactly say what you talked about, but in general terms, could you? I will say that the result was he just seemed more appreciative and loving after you talked with him.
Oh, how interesting. I think that what I do is I say, I'm here to have a conversation about the end of life, if you want to have it. And so, you know, just like the film is a conversation starter. I mean, I would say when people watch my film, everybody's instantly aware of, well, the deaths that they've experienced weren't the deaths that were in my movie. And of course, that's good. I mean,
everybody's death is unique, just like everybody's life.
That's beautiful. But it does make people want to talk about it. And I think that's the value. And I think just by really being pretty straightforward with people, I find that's useful.
Do you find anybody who's just totally resistant? And is there anything you can do in that situation? Does want to think about their death? Maybe even denies that it's a possibility, though I guess in the back of their mind,
I'm sure that exists. For sure, that exists, and you know, I'm not going to push it. One of my more recent teachers didn't want to talk about anything, and taught me the value of silence in a way that I had not learned until being with her. She was on hospice. And I would visit, and I would start to blah, blah, and she would not talk back. And I knew she was hearing me. She had just made a decision not to talk. And so I would just stay in silence. And that made a difference. I could put my hand out and touch her and know that I was, you know, that she knew that I was there and we were there together. But the silence was the most important thing. And just the being there was more important than any words could have communicated, I guess. Uh-huh. So that's something new for me. She was my teacher of the value of silence, something that, you know, we give a lot of lip service to being and not doing, but that was a very huge lesson in being and not doing, because even speaking is a doing.
Oh, yes. I have one last question, and this came up recently for me. There's a writer I've interviewed several times. We were talking about a new 2-volume set of books that are coming out in the next few months. And he had a daughter who he loved just considerably. I knew about that because I've known him for a while. And I found out while talking to him that she actually died last year. And she was in her early 20s, so really tragic, very sad. But I had no idea what to say to him other than, you know, I'm really sorry for your loss. You know, kind of the usual platitudes. Right. It's terrible for a parent to lose a child. Do you have any advice on that? What can you say? How somebody who's grieving. So it's not just the person dying now, it's the person who's living with that grief.
It's so deep. Grief is so deep. And just like each death, you know, each grieving person is going to have a unique experience. And it isn't a platitude to wish that person comfort. It's actually, you know, that's what we wish for people, is that they would at some point get comfort. So I think acknowledging, you know, grief, acknowledging, like, often people try to, you know, like, change the subject. And I think it's mostly a lot of people who are grieving want to talk about the person that they're missing. They, you know,
so you kind of follow their lead.
I always follow the lead, but I do invite stories. You know, do you have a story you want to tell me, something about this person that's not here anymore? There's a lot of books written about how to be with people who are grieving, and there's a lot of really good books, so it's hard for me to come up with it really fast and short. But I think no advice, just
be there,
presence,
be kind,
and willingness to stay present, and willingness to allow grief to be a journey. You know, it is a journey, and it never ends. And so acknowledging that the person's always going to be in one phase or another of that journey.
Well, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today. I'd like to go out with something that you said about the film, and I'm quoting, "It's not really about dying at all. It's all about how am I living, because I actually could die tomorrow, and so is today the life I want." Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Kathy Zeutlin, filmmaker and director-writer-producer of the documentary Living While Dying from Portland's Peace Films. You can learn more about Kathy and the film online at livingwhiledying.org, and you can watch the film for free on YouTube. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, September 28th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
there's supposedly only two things certain in life, which are death and taxes. And the good news is I only have one to worry about this year. Because I've had my accountant file for an extension.